Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Boris Fishman. He is the author of a new memoir called Savage Feast. And it's a great expose of his journey from former Soviet Union country to America. And it's really a great, great memoir. And so I'm really excited to have him on to talk about it. But first, let's talk about what's going on in the news. As we all know, what else is going on in the news? We've had the most crazy election season I can ever remember, and it continues. And I actually don't want to take a lot of time talking about it because we're all being bombarded from all areas about that. So I think I'm going to take this week off talking about politics. We can come back to it next week when we see where we are at. But I am going to really focus on food. This will be my first year after 25 years of not doing a huge Thanksgiving feast for the homeless. For those of you that have been following me for a long time, you know that every Thanksgiving season, I gather over 100 volunteers to come through the IE Green Homestead to help me prepare food for about 1,000 people in partnership with the River Fund New York, which is a nonprofit food pantry that really addresses poverty in a holistic way. Unlike most food pantries, they really know all of their clients. They really look at poverty and hunger as a systemic issue and really look at the whole family. And they realize that the path out of poverty is education. If one of the young people in the family actually goes to school and comes out being able to get a good job, they are going to raise the whole family out of poverty. And so they have a program called From Cradle to College, where they really help support the families from, you know, having baby showers when the moms get pregnant, helping supply them with school supplies as the kids grow up, and then really giving out grants to the older kids when they go off to college. You know, most of the kids receive financial aid, which pays for the actual college tuition, but it doesn't cover things like books and rent and food, which very often are the reasons kids have to drop out of school, because they have to help their families. And so they make these bridge loans or these bridge grants to the kids so that they can actually stay in school. So the River Fund New York is a really unique, incredible food pantry. And so I love supporting them. I've been working with them, like I said, for 25 years. But this year, due to the pandemic, we will not be cooking our Thanksgiving meal. However, the River Fund hopes to collect at least 4,000 turkeys. And so I am reaching out to my community, asking for people that donated turkeys in years past to still bring the turkeys. I just won't be cooking them. I will be donating them whole to the River Fund, who will then pass them out to their families. Obviously, these will only go to families that actually have the means for cooking. So the people that are really homeless, that are, you know, that do not have a place to cook a turkey, they will have to find another place or hopefully be invited into someone else's home. But I really don't know the answer. But in addition to the turkeys, as always, I will be collecting coats and blankets and sleeping bags, hats, gloves, boots, everything to help keep these people who don't have homes warm during the winter. So I will start collecting on Sunday, November 22nd, which is the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And I hope you all reach out to me at Bhavani at IE Green to find out where you can drop the things off. Also, I just want to share with all of you, depending on how things go with this election. I know I said I'm not going to be talking about politics, but just a little plug. There is a place where you can register to, in New York City anyway, to protect the results action. You know, to get out into the streets and be prepared to fight for our democracy, which is just, you know, really at stake here. And then I want to also talk to you about the kids that are now doing so much of their learning at home, online. It's really a dangerous place for kids to be roaming. The internet, YouTube, you know, even these channels for YouTube that are supposed to be kid friendly. I was just reading about this and I actually wrote about it in my newsletter, that big media companies and fast food companies, they're all targeting kids in these YouTube channels. And it's really, really a problem that they, you know, thinly veil these ads for sugary beverages, junk food, fast food in the actual programming. You know, there was a article in the New York Times recently that talked about, you know, this one show where, you know, the kid was pretending he was a cashier at McDonald's. And this is a subtle way of getting that advertising about McDonald's into the program without it being an actual commercial. And there's nothing that really helps us screen that. It's really unfortunate, but there's, you know, no way to really know unless you're sitting right there with your child while they're doing it, to know which channels are targeting them and which ones aren't. So I really encourage you to actually sit there on occasion and really kind of screen what you're letting your kids watch. I know so much learning is happening online and there's so many great sites, and I've shared many over the past few months while we've been quarantining that are educational, that really have good content for you to use. There is one site that I know of called Family Friendly Sites, which actually vets different programs to be kid friendly, you know, where they won't allow bad advertising on there, and the site is really vetted to be okay for children. So check out Family Friendly Sites. And if you want to know how your senators and representatives vote, there's actually a great website that you can go to at foodpolicyaction.org. You can go to their scorecard and click on different states, and you can see how your senators and Congress, senators and representatives have voted, which, you know, really can be very, very helpful. Also, when we're buying food, because so much food is, even organic food is being bought up by mega corporations, that a product that we once thought was good and healthy, you know, changes. And so it's always helpful to keep these websites in your back pocket so that you can check out ingredients. One of them is the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. They have great, great scorecards for water, for skincare products and cosmetics. They have, they're the ones that have the Dirty Dozen list, which are the 12 fruits and vegetables that are most heavily sprayed that you want to avoid eating non-organic. They also have a list called the Clean 15. You know, money is an issue for so many of us. You know, where do you want to spend your money? We know that organic, unfortunately, costs a little bit more. So for a product like avocado that is on the Clean 15 list, is it worth spending an extra dollar on each avocado? Maybe not. So the Clean 15 list is the ones you don't have to worry about so much. There's a scorecard on a water filtering guide, different alternative milks, which is really great. I always share their scorecard on sunscreen in the summertime. They have a scorecard on seafood. They even have one on cell phones. So that's a really wonderful one. Another one I want to share with you is the Cornucopia Institute. they have great scorecards as well. And I was just checking out their scorecard on plant-based beverages, and they are not all created equal. The scoring system that they use is really in depth, from, you know, sourcing to nutritional value and everything in between. And so that's a really great thing to check out as well. Of course, I want to share with you my recipe this week. And I actually am sharing with you a recipe that I shared at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were all having to go inside and I felt like our immune system was really being challenged. And here it is again. We're getting ready to go inside. The rates of the virus is spreading and growing, and there's no end really in sight. I mean, a vaccine is, you know, certainly off in the future. It's not happening anytime really soon. And when it happens, whether or not you're going to feel comfortable taking it is a whole nother issue. So it behooves us all to strengthen our immune system. And this miso vegetable chowder with wakame and ramen noodles is certainly a recipe that you want to keep close at hand. So I'm going to share that with you right now. I start with 12 cups of water in a pot. I add 6 cloves of garlic to that, a piece of ginger root, like a 2 to 3 inch piece. And I actually cut it into a couple different pieces, big enough so that you can take them out, because you don't want to bite into it. But by cutting it up, you just get a little bit more flavor out of it. 1 cake of tofu. You can use soft or firm, whichever you prefer in this recipe. If you use soft, you want to hold off and add it towards the end of the recipe, because when you stir the soup, the soft can tend to break apart, and you don't want that to happen. 1 organic onion chopped. 1 organic carrot washed and chopped. 2 parsnips peeled and diced, 2 cups of organic broccoli florets, 1 cup of napa cabbage, 1 cup of bok choy, 8 ounces of shiitake mushrooms, stems removed and thinly sliced, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of tamari, 1 tablespoon sherry or red wine, 2 tablespoons of wakame, which is a seaweed, and you're going to soak that in a cup of boiling water to reconstitute it, and just let that sit on the side till you're ready to use it. 4 to 5 tablespoons of white miso and 4 to 5 tablespoons of red miso, and 1 8-ounce package of ramen noodles. And you can cook those according to the directions. Then when they're ready, you just run them under cold water and set those aside. And then I like to serve it with some Japanese hot sprinkle of pepper called shishin togarashi. And this is, you know, just a spicy red pepper mixture. It has some orange peel in it or lemon peel, and it's delicious. You could also serve it with some gamasio if you'd like. So you fill the pot with water, and you're going to add the onions, the carrots, the garlic, ginger, parsnips, and let that come to a boil. Then you can reduce the heat and let it simmer for about 20 minutes. Add the greens, the broccoli, the napa cabbage, the bok choy, and you can add the tofu at this point. And that, as I said before, if you are using soft tofu, you can even wait and add the tofu just a little bit before serving it. You're going to drain the wakame and then add the wakame to the soup. Let it cook for another 10 minutes or so. And while that's simmering, you're going to saute the shiitake mushrooms. And I saute the shiitake mushrooms so that they can get crispy, and I can add them to the top of the soup, the sprinkle them on the top of the soup when I serve it. So you're going to saute the shiitake mushrooms in olive oil with 1 teaspoon of minced garlic and cook it for about 5 minutes until the outside of the shiitake mushrooms become seared. You're going to add some wine and some tamari and let that continue cooking until it's crispy and caramelized on the outside. And just set those aside until we're ready to serve. And then you're going to remove a cup of the broth only from the big pot and dilute it with the 8 tablespoons of miso in another little bowl and just mix that up. Once you add the miso back into the pot, one thing to keep in mind is you don't want to let the soup boil at that point, because the medicinal value of the miso will be destroyed if you let it boil. So you just let it simmer. And then you can keep the noodles separate, and I put the noodles into each bowl. if you have a pot of just plain hot water, you can dip the noodles in the hot water before putting them in the bowl just to take the chill off of them. But then add the hot broth right on top and that will finish heating up the noodles. And garnish each bowl with some of the freshly cooked shiitake mushrooms and serve the hot pepper sprinkle on the side. And that is it. You can also garnish with some cilantro leaves if you like. That always is a nice, delicious add-on. So that's it. And this soup is just really such good comfort food. I hope you all make it. Let me know if you like it. Feel free to adjust the vegetables to what you have in the house or what you really love. You want to put in some other different vegetables. I sometimes put in green beans, I put in cauliflower, some squash. This is the season for squash. So really whatever you like can go into this soup. And you can also keep it simple and just do onions and carrots and nothing else. So let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week, Boris Fishman. He's the author of many novels, A Replacement Life, which won the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award and the American Library Association Sophie Brody Medal, and Don't Let My Baby Do Rodeo, both New York Times notable books of the year. And his latest is the memoir I was talking to you about earlier called Savage Feast, which is a family memoir told through recipes. And all of his books are published through HarperCollins. His journalism has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and the list goes on. He currently is living in Montana, where he teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Montana in Missoula. And The Savage Feast, Three Generations, Two Continents, and a Dinner Table was actually the book that my book club read this month. In two different book clubs, one with the Long Island Food Network Alliance and also with Slow Food North Shore. And so this book really got all of us talking and it was just really great. So, Boris, are you with me?
I'm here.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's a pleasure to have you. So we've all really enjoyed your book. I have not totally finished it, but I've gotten, you know, good way through it. I wanted to just start by asking you what inspired you to write this memoir.
I guess the original reason is something that shows up in the memoir relatively briefly now, which is my grandfather, my grandmother, who was sort of the kitchen wizard in our family, she passed away in 2004 and he was left alone. And he was very lucky to have come into his life a homemade, which was, I guess, a social benefit provided by the city of New York, just some assistance around the house. A woman from Ukraine who was just a phenomenal cook. And, but she was also in many ways a really rare kind of person. And even though nothing romantic ever developed between them, they became, I think, closer to each other than even he was with us. And she kept him alive through her care for much longer than he would have survived otherwise. And thanks to her ministrations, sort of, he was there for us for a longer period of time. But like I say, she was an amazing cook and we were introduced to her cooking because she became a fixture in his life. And I just, you know, we're from Belarus, she's from Ukraine. These places were not far from each other, but they were far enough. Belarus is northern, Ukraine is southern. And so her repertoire was just so very different. It opened my eyes to the kind of dishes. You know, I think I'd grown up being a bit ashamed of Soviet cooking, and she very much continued to cook in a Soviet way. But the dishes were excellent, and I just ended up becoming curious, and I ended up learning a bit about how to make them from her. It ended up bringing me a bit closer to the culture that I was leaving behind already, partly because of these embarrassments. So it just ended up providing a lot for our lives, and at a certain point, I began to think that their relationship And her cooking was worth chronicling in a book. The big question was just how to weave it all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. So did they ever get married, or they were just in a relationship through her being his caretaker?
Yeah, they never had a romantic relationship. The important thing for them was that by this point, my grandfather's, the next two generations, my parents and I, we had both Americanized to such a degree after 20 years in the country that we were all kind of foreigners to each other. And I think when this woman appeared in his life, she had just immigrated from Ukraine not long before. She was from rural Ukraine. Not much had changed there since the Soviet period. My grandfather certainly continued to live a very Soviet life, even in New York, which you can do there. Russian newspapers, Russian television, Russian food stores, right? You don't have to learn any English in order to survive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly this woman, who was very much a citizen of the same emotional and psychological country as he was, suddenly showed up in his life and just provided the most meaningful kind of companionship. It wasn't romantic at all, but it didn't have to be. Meanwhile, she also left behind a family in Ukraine, two children whom she missed very much. And I think in him, she found a reminder of home, all the way in the United States here. And so they just provided each other with emotional comfort and nourishment that they wouldn't have found in many other places in this country. So it was just a lucky, lucky companionship for both of them.
Mm-hmm. I briefly had shared with you when we were communicating prior to the interview that I had a similar relationship or a similar situation in my family, where my mother had a stroke and she needed 24/7 care. And so we had a healthcare aide that came in from the Republic of Georgia, also former Soviet yeah. Union, also similar
That's right.
cooking style as to a lot of the foods that we were used to. And then when my mother passed, she was still there, and my father and she ended up in a relationship. And it was wonderful because, like you said, she kept my father alive and kept him with us for many, many more years than he would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I should say that during the Soviet period, Georgia was the place whose cooking we all looked to for spice and flavor and textures. Like in Belarus, we had potatoes, we had cabbage, we had beets. There weren't a lot of spices in our cooking. And like the Soviet housewives created incredible things from the very limited bounty that we had in a place like that. Ukraine was a bit better off because, like I say, people don't realize it, but Ukraine is as far south as Provence is. And so they have watermelons and pumpkins and eggplant and all sorts of things like that. They have a slightly more broader repertoire, but Georgia and the Central Asian republics like Uzbekistan and so forth, those were the places you went to get the best food, and why eateries and restaurants from those places were the most popular places to eat in Moscow and Leningrad and Minsk and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This woman is an amazing chef or cook as well. And taught me so many things, which I have, I share a recipe every week, and I have shared many of her recipes that I have, adapted to our ingredients. And yeah, it's been really wonderful. So how old were you when you came over?
So I was 9. We were supposed to leave right after I was born. My birth was basically the catalyst for their decision to leave. We were Jews. We are Jews. And for Jewish people in the Soviet Union, it was not a good life. Jews were severely discriminated against. You couldn't get a job. You couldn't get into university. However, my grandfather was a real kind of master wheeler and dealer who knew how to operate on the black market to get us all sorts of things that we could not get because of our lack of access to resources, right? And this is a country where resources are severely limited because it's a command economy. No one knows how to produce anything. supply and demand is really screwed up. And so there's not a lot of quality stuff. And it's typically reserved for people with access, with power, with political connections. And my grandfather, who was just a simple barber, thanks to his personality and his connections, was able to get for us the things that we needed. And so actually, in secret, it wasn't a bad life. And they had no great incentive to leave until I was born. And they kind of decided that they wanted to save me from all the unfair treatment that they'd received for no reason other than their religion. And they weren't even religious people. They were completely secular people. But the fact that they were Jewish marked them and set them apart as far as the rest of the country was concerned. And it was just a severely constricting reality for them. But unfortunately, I was born in February of 1979. We tried to, you know, apply for permission to leave. And here's where geopolitics got in the way. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in December of 1979, and the Americans boycotted the Moscow Olympics then in retaliation in summer of 1980. And the Soviets retaliated in turn by closing the gates to all those Soviet citizens who wished to leave and had gotten permission to leave to America, and that included us. And so we were stuck there for another 8 years. For me, it was a very consequential 8 years, because if I'd left at zero or just shy of one, I think I would have ended up perhaps a very different person in America than I am now, having lived in that country for 9 years. But I guess I should say Soviet families are very insular, and I continued to live in a kind of Soviet bubble even after we came here, probably until I left my family home in my 20s. So that probably wouldn't have changed a great deal if I'd come as just an infant. Basically, the Soviet life leaves a very, very heavy psychological imprint on a person, and it kind of doesn't matter where you're living.
And where did you settle when you moved to this country?
So we put up same place where most people put up, which was New York City. I forget exactly why. You needed sponsoring organizations in order to receive permission, right, for the American government to feel like you wouldn't be a financial burden. And there were just more of them in the New York City area, which I think is part of the reason that so many ex-Soviet Jews settled there. We settled in Brooklyn, and, you know, we lived in an information blockade. The people who were in charge of our country did not want us to know the true facts about what life was like outside the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was paradise, is what we were supposed to think, and everywhere else was hell. But the people who'd managed to get out sent back very different stories. And I think those among them who'd gotten out to the United States actually ended up having sometimes pretty hard times here, because it's not easy to get started here, not easy to get started anywhere. But I think they wanted to make it seem to us that they were doing really well and to brag a little bit. And so the stories we got about America made it feel like a country where money grew on trees, you know, just a really promised land. And it's not at all what we discovered when we came here. It's a thoroughly imperfect country like any other. And so for us, you know, we arrived in the fall. It was October, November, pretty grim, gray time in southern Brooklyn. It was a pretty hard first year, as we wondered a lot about what we'd gotten ourselves into. And, you know, there are all sorts of ways in which, I mean, America is incomparably a freer, more just society than the Soviet Union ever was. But it's got a lot of problems itself, as we're seeing these days.
As we're living through right now. Uh-huh.
Exactly.
And was food always, I know, you know, in Jewish culture, food is certainly a central theme in every event. I mean, you don't get together just to go for a walk. You get together for breakfast or brunch, get together for lunch, you get together for dinner.
Exactly.
You know, and everything else happens around that. Was it the same for you?
Yeah, so it was even more than that. Two things. One is that, three things, I guess. One is that good food was hard to find. It was scarce for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Second, there wasn't that much to do in terms of recreation and leisure in the Soviet Union, right? Like, the incredible number of things that an American person has at their disposal for entertainment, forget even like the television or the laptop. I'm talking about just like all the businesses that exist to supply you with diversions. Like, none of that existed in the Soviet Union. It was not a capitalist free market society where people were allowed to, you know, become entrepreneurs and open businesses. So basically, you could go to the movies, you could take a walk in the park, you could maybe, you know, get involved in like some sports club of some kind. But generally, there wasn't that much to do. And so people, when they had time for leisure, and they did have plenty of time for leisure because Soviet jobs rarely kept them very long hours, they just went over to each other's house to talk. And, hospitality traditions are very strong in that culture. You're not going to have someone over to talk without putting something on the table. And so very many human experiences revolved around food. But specifically, to go back to the first reason why, because it was scarce, because there wasn't enough to go around, particularly high quality items. If you had access to those things, as my grandfather did because of his connections, you could use that stuff like currency, right? In the Soviet Union, a surgeon and a janitor both earned roughly the same thing, about $100 a month, right? So if you wanted to, I mean, there are all sorts of things. For an example, let's say that you're a person who wants access to a good pediatrician so that you can have them on speed dial, so to speak, not that we had speed dial, when your child gets sick, right? Like they do house calls, those people, but they go first to the homes of people with the influence, the power, the connections, the money, the access, right? And so if you want to get in ahead of that line, you just let that person know that through you, they can have access to all sorts of luxury food items they wouldn't have access to otherwise, right? Stuff from outside the country, things from Italy, things from France, you know, those things did get into the country, just they weren't widely available. But even homegrown production, right? There's a difference between a pork tenderloin that's spoiled and a pork tenderloin that's not, right? And so my grandfather was able to do those things for us. And it was always very interesting to me that food became this kind of coin that you could use to acquire more power in this very screwed up society.
Very interesting. I can imagine how you can really bribe somebody with some good food if they didn't normally have access to that. Things like, you know, certain things that you talked about in the book that I know was a part of my family growing up, but I never really heard it outside of my family, was things like tongue. You know, you talk about, tongue. And I remember as a kid, you know, the first time it dawned on me that that was a tongue from a cow, I almost flipped out. I mean, it was just, tongue was the name of the meat. I had no idea that it was a tongue from a cow. Was that a common food for everybody in Belarus, or was that more of a Jewish food?
No, it was for everyone. And what it, you know, nose to tail eating has become big in America recently, partly as a way to reduce waste, partly to make meat consumption more meaningful. And this is no different. You know, it was done for a slightly different reason. It wasn't done for eco-conscious or ideological reasons. It was done because, you know, in a country where there isn't enough food, you're going to make use of everything. And this was an edible part of an animal. And if you do the right things with it, it's delicious as hell. And you're absolutely right. Every single person you mentioned this to, they flip out because it's just kind of inconceivable to eat the tongue of a cow. But, you know, America is a very egocentric place, right? But like some of the things that America puts on the table, they're not strange parts of an animal, but they're utterly bizarre. From muffins to the fact that, like, I don't know, I just saw a commercial for a Papa John pizza that's actually, it's a pizzadilla. It's a pizza folded over like a quesadilla with mm-hmm. ingredients for Mexican cooking. What, like, I mean, that's high insanity right there. But I don't think any American would find that particularly strange. But it is. It is profoundly strange to do that in the name of commerce. So it's just, for us, it wasn't strange at all to eat tongue. I guess the most important thing is, like, can you make it taste good? And if that's the ultimate test, and we did, right? You boil it in a water based broth that's spiked with a ton of spices. I was listening to you list off all the things that you put into that hearty soup you were mentioning, Same idea here, just a ton of nutmeg, allspice, you know, peppercorns, coriander, dill weed, whatever you've got, just toss it in there. And then once you take it out, that's not the end. You buy some sort of, instead of buying it at the store, you've got one thing that people did have a lot often was their own gardens, right? And these gardens, the soil was very fertile, and the things that you got out of it tasted very, very good. To this day, Belarus is sort of renowned in Europe for having high quality products that are never produced with the aid of pesticides. They're always non-GMO. It's just sort of the way things are done there. It's not a very industrial society. Maybe that's part of the reason. But we lived that way during Soviet times because we didn't have, you know, industrial agriculture. We didn't have refrigeration. We didn't have some of these things, some of these dubious advances that gave American food what they did in the 1950s and so forth. We just had gardens, and you pulled a horseradish stalk out of the garden and you peeled it and you grated it over your tongue, and it was heaven, especially right. on a piece of bread. That was a full meal. For people who didn't have a lot, that kept you going.
Right, right. Another thing I found really interesting in the book was your stopover in Vienna and then Italy. And when you were in Italy, you know, you talked about the food and the deliciousness, and then coming to America and being shocked at the food having no flavor, still looking beautiful, but having no flavor. You want to share a little bit about that with us? Because there's definitely, you talk about in the book, you know, tomatoes for people with money and tomatoes for people without money.
This is what I was referring to when I was talking about the initial disappointments that we encountered here. And of course, it was no one's fault but our own because of the expectations we had. Why should any place sustain such high expectations? But, you know, in the name of efficiency, in the name of cost savings, what industrialized agriculture produced for America just has been an utter disaster. And yes, the result is that you have one tomato that is colorless and flavorless, but costs 89 cents a pound. And then you have a tomato raised the proper way that costs $3 or $4 or $5 a pound, depending on where you are. Well, the magic of the Soviet Union was that you had the nice tomato only, and it cost almost nothing. I mean, people had nothing. They had no money, right? When you earn $100 a month, you don't really have a lot of money. But that tomato cost next to nothing. Everything cost next to nothing. It just didn't enter into people's heads to do things differently. However screwed up that place was, there were, among the people in charge, some very correct ideas about certain environmental things sometimes. Culturally, it just sort of, no one did that. There was not chemical filler to the same degree. I think maybe it was only because they hadn't figured out how to do that, and they happily would have if they could. They just didn't have the systems to be that massive and efficient about it. But ordinary people were the beneficiaries, right? People ate like people never watched what they ate, but the stuff that they put in their bodies was always of a very high quality. The butter always came from somewhere nearby, because there just weren't the systems to transport it very far. And so to come here and to lay your eyes, right, also, like, it was so strictly seasonal for the same reasons. Like, there was not the means to produce strawberries in December. So we had strawberries only for the summer. It's like everyone's grandparents. You canned, right? You stored, you pickled. You come here and it's December, right? We got here, it was November. We go to the store in December, there's strawberries on the shelf. And you're just like, oh my God, this place is magic. They look a little weird because instead of being red all the way through, they're half white, half red. But okay, maybe they got a different strain here. You splurge on the strawberries because they are more expensive in December. You bring them home, you bite into one, you don't taste anything.
Right.
And
sour,
that moment is
sour
very,
and wet is all you taste.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very dispiriting moment. It's basically like, you know, the emperor has no clothes. The magician's trick is no trick. Like, wow, these Americans dreamed up how to do strawberries in December. This is an amazing country. But then, like, it's a lie. And, like, another funny thing completely unrelated to food is, you know, we didn't have advertising in the Soviet Union. What a profound blessing that was. We didn't have advertising. There was just no I mean, advertising by definition is a kind of misinformation in the name of sales. And we just did not have that because it was anathema to the way our society had been structured. And like, this was a perfect example of just utter falsehood in advertising, right? Like, somebody created a bad product and put it on the shelf and hopes you will pay for it. Like, it was a very hard thing to understand.
Mm-hmm. I bet. What was the most traumatic part of coming to America for you? You know, was it the journey and stopping in Vienna and Italy, or was it actually getting here and the shock of the culture difference? What was most traumatic for you as a 9-year-old boy?
I think it's what I'm describing. And I think I'm hitting it so hard, not only because it was difficult then. I mean, to be honest, I individually probably did not feel fully how difficult it was because I was only 9 years old and I was sheltered. And when you're 9, you don't understand the difference between a good strawberry and a bad strawberry. I think this issue has become for me much more pronounced since. The biggest difficulty, there have been two. The first difficulty is that I have never found a way to feel fully at home in America. I speak the language. I'm fluent in the language. I've achieved things here, which I'm very proud of. It would be very strange for me to pick up and go live in Scotland. Like, I'm stuck here. But it's not a culture and a society that's ever made much sense to me. It's preoccupations. It's argue. I mean, you're seeing it play out literally today in our country. It's just, I grew up, I'm a far more European person in terms of my hangups and obsessions and curiosities and predicaments. And that's never gone away. And it has always, there's always like a hair under the collar. There's always like a bone stuck in your throat because you just don't feel that deep down sense of belonging. I think the people in life who do feel belonging don't know what its absence is like. It literally doesn't enter into their minds because why would it? But the people who don't feel belonging, it's just like a pebble in your shoe existentially every minute of every day of your life. And that's very much been an aspect of my American experience that's been very, very hard and remains so to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, our society is made up of so many people from so many different places that, you know, people, you know, your culture is kind of what your family brought to it. And it can be very different than your neighbors. And there's, you know, there's a few things that can be unifying, but so many of the things actually become more dividing than unifying. And
no,
you know, that's certainly a challenge.
I'm not interested in a homogeneous society. I'm all for every kind of diversity. It's just that there is an incredibly Puritan, morally prude, socially conservative, and anti-intellectual strain in American culture that I find repugnant. And it's astounding. I don't want to be a part of their country.
I lost you.
I was just saying that it's astounding to me how many people in this country proudly belong to that tradition. And, you know, I don't want to be a part of their country.
Right, right. I hear you. You know, for me, food has become such a central role because of for a couple of reasons, actually. One, because it does bring people together to talk. Like you talked about, you know, back in the old country, there wasn't a lot to do. And the thing that people did do was getting together to talk and eat and sit around the table. And that was the entertainment. And for me, that still is my favorite entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like the most real thing that we can all do together to really communicate and to share ideas and understand each other. And good food is really important. And so much of the food in this country is so bad. It is amazing to me. And so, you know, the way I came to food was as a mom, you know, when you are feeding your kids and you want it to be healthy. And so much of the food out there you know, I was talking earlier in my opening about the advertisement that kids are being bombarded with. They're targeted to go, you know, I raised my kids, you know, without going to McDonald's and Burger King and, you know, special birthday parties, they could go and get French fries there or maybe an occasional fish sandwich, but that was it, you know. You know, there was just so much bad food around you that you really had to navigate it. And as a parent, you know, with peer pressure, kids are so, they want to do what everybody else is doing. You know, they want to be like everybody else and they want to eat the same foods as everybody else. And if you're trying to raise your child eating healthier food, vegetarian or not, you know, even if, you know, when my son expressed the desire to eat chicken, I was like, okay, you can have chicken, but I was going to get him organic chicken that didn't have antibiotics and hormones and GMO food and all that stuff. So, right. You know, when you bring in those differences and impart them on your children and then they do it, it's challenging. It's challenging for them. It's challenging for everyone. And so you try to surround yourself with people that are similar so that you're not the only one, you know, eating differently, but it's definitely a challenge.
I agree with you that the table is one of the last places of joy during this time. Both by this time, I'm referring both to the political moment and to the pandemic.
Right.
And for me, you know, through the woman's name was Oksana. And through Oksana, I became not only much more connected to my culture, which, as I said, was sort of dissipating in me by that point, but I also became a better cook. I've always been a home cook because, you know, I started out as a freelance journalist, and that's not a life that allows you for a lot of takeout, financially speaking, for financial reasons, rather. But cooking remains a tremendous part of my life, and I've never been happier than the 6 months that I spent as a prep cook in a restaurant in New York City on the Lower East Side, which I did in 2015. Sort of walking through those doors, and vanishing inside that sort of sanctorum of the kitchen, where I was from 2 p.m. to midnight, never exited, and just lost myself in that physical activity. Right? Making something out of nothing, making nourishment for people out of raw, inedible ingredients. I mean, for me, that was just one of the happiest things I could do with my life. And I continue to sort of inside the four walls of my kitchen on an almost daily basis. And it's an indispensable part of what keeps me sane. And if I walk away from writing for any reason, it would be for a job in some kitchen somewhere. I think they're both equally unlucrative life professions, but it would be worth it.
I know. I mean, cooking for people is definitely one of my joys. You know, it's feeding people and making people happy. And like you said, you know, I grow most of my own vegetables in season, but I'm in New York, so, you know, I can't grow year round, but I grow a lot and then, you know, I freeze a lot. I don't do that much canning, but I do quite a bit of freezing. And, you know, the flavor is just can't be compared with what you can get in the supermarket, you know?
That's right.
You know, I don't trust a lot of the imported foods that they say they're organic. You know, I feel like, you know, in our country, we barely can inspect things. How can I trust inspection coming in from another country? So, you know, I try to buy as much local and eat seasonal. And so, you know, coming into the colder weather, we definitely do more stews and root vegetables and beans and, you know, heavier stuff. But really, you know, kind of warming comfort food, you know, this time of year.
You know,
what were some of your favorite dishes? Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say very quickly that I was interviewing a chef in Bozeman, Montana for an article that I was writing for a travel magazine. And he said, he quoted something wonderful from Thomas Keller, French Laundry per se, all those restaurants. And according to him, Thomas Keller said that if you can find better ingredients than I can, then you will be a better chef than I could be. So much has to do with the quality of the ingredients. But to answer your question, which dishes are in heavy rotation? So I have, you know, 25 recipes in the book. I was very happy because we went out to the last farmer's market of the season here the other day, and there was a gentleman from a nearby farm, and he just had 1 million peppers. And so I bought up all these peppers, and I roasted them. And there's a really cool recipe in the book for just roasted peppers marinated in like buckwheat, honey, lemon, and garlic. Wow. I went in a different direction. Yeah, no, so good, right? I went in a different direction. I made a kind of pepper sauce out of them with celery leaves and almonds and olive oil and whatnot. So we just have this jar of really delicious, like this kick of summery pepper sauce in the middle of, we already had a foot of snow a week ago. So it's deep winter here. Another one that I absolutely love is the polenta. It's called banash in Ukrainian, and it's what the shepherds make when they head up into the mountains to graze their sheep. But for our purposes, it could Ukrainians braise in dairy rather than water or stock, and so it's fine cornmeal braised in a combination of sour cream and milk. It's rich, but it's so good with that sort of sour tang, and it's got some salt and sugar in it. You could saute some mushrooms and toss like some coriander and paprika and garlic in there, and maybe some feta cheese on top if you have it. That combo, it's a great vegetarian dish. It comes together in 15 minutes on a weeknight. It's so filling for everyone. It's perfect for the winter. One of my favorites.
Uh-huh. Sounds yum. Sounds yum.
It is. Yeah.
Cool. So, and how was the relationship with Oksana, with you and the rest of the family? Did everybody welcome her in, or was there some animosity, or how was that from the family when she came in?
No, we
kind of stepped into your grandmother's shoes.
Yeah, she saved us in so many ways. We were really disoriented. We were a small family to begin with. People did not have a lot of kids in the Soviet Union, too many mouths to feed, too many mouths to protect. And so my mom's an only child, I'm an only child. To lose my grandmother, it was, the first death we'd had in our family in a very long time. And suddenly we went from five to four. And I think of the five Olympic rings, right? If one of them falls out, it's a very odd looking image. And that was us. And Oksana came in and just brought, she's an incredible person. She's not a person of, extreme education or anything like that, but she is so wise and calm and measured and thoughtful and attentive, just a profoundly good person. Her temperament is just an astounding temperament, so resilient. She's gone through more in her life than any of us will ever go through, and she had nothing but a kind of hopeful perspective every single day. And I'm saying, like, all of us, and I didn't get to talk about this, but there are many difficult things that happen for an immigrant child once he or she arrives in America with regard to his family. Their expectations, their lessons, they're all shaped by a Soviet experience that has no utility for a kid trying to grow up in this very different society. My parents wanted me to succeed in American ways, but using Soviet methods. And so I'm not speaking abstractly. I'm just talking about the fact that, like, in Soviet culture, risk-taking, innovation, exploration of the new, like, all of that is strongly discouraged. But you can't get anywhere in America without deploying those characteristics. And so I was very stuck between knowing I had to do that to give them what they wanted, which was achievement and success, and then on the other hand, feeling like I was betraying them in another way by pursuing these curiosities and goals. And so it's a very confusing time. No one had the self-awareness or the psychological self-understanding to articulate and understand and acknowledge and accept. And so we were just all kind of disoriented in multiple ways and having a very hard time with each other. I was becoming increasingly disenchanted with the home culture because I found it to be responsible for so many of these difficulties. And then Oksana came into our lives and just became this kind of vector that changed all the dynamics, right? She just provided an uncomplicated joy. She put, like, she invited us to their home, and the table was always covered with the most amazing food and drink. And for like 2 or 3 hours, we just forgot everything other than the pleasures and the joys of being with people you are related to and care about. while you're eating great food. And that was, it's hard to overestimate the kind of gift that that was.
Yeah. Yeah, I can feel it because, like I said, I experienced it a bit. I mean, you know, Dolly, who came into our life, she was a great cook, and she definitely, you know, comforted my father and gave him, you know, six more wonderful years that he would not have had otherwise. But they lived on our property. So they, you know, they had, we had bought a piece of property the year before my mother had her stroke so that they could, my parents could grow old with us right here. And so there were two houses on the property. And, but, you know, my mother moved in already stroked. So, you know, I was providing a lot of the food and the table situation, but it was really nice to have someone to be here cooking with and learning from, because she, you know, cooked daily. And it was just really so joyful. And like you said, the things that she went through in her life before coming here is more than most of us ever have to go through who grew up here. And so I just have so much appreciation and awe for her, as well as it sounds like you have for Oksana. So I just want to thank you for writing this book, Boris. It was just, it's great. I'm looking forward to finishing it. And I know, you know, the others in our book club who did finish it loved it. And I just want to thank you and keep writing.
Thank you so much for spending time with it. And thank you for having me on to talk about it. It was a pleasure, Bhavani. Thank you.
You're so welcome. And everyone out there, stay calm. We will get through this. Cook some good food, make some good soup, and I will see you all again next week. Bye for now.